Michael Garr's latest book, Portrait of a Novel, is the story of how The Portrait of a Lady came to be written. And in that telling, he gives us a new and vivid depiction of the life and times of its famously elusive author, Henry James. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm pleased that it brings Michael Garr, the Mary Augusta Jordan Professor of English Language and Literature at Smith College, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
There have been quite a few very distinguished biographies of Henry James. What did you hope to add to the picture?
Well, the first thing I wanted to do was I didn't start out to write a biography. I started out to write a book about this novel. And then I found that in order to tell the story of the novel, to construct one I wanted to do as a story, I had to get more and more biographical. But I wasn't interested in writing a straight, cradle-to-grave biography. I wanted to focus on this book, and so I used the years around the writing of the portrait as a kind of fulcrum to organize his life around.
Well, aren't most readers more likely to read a biography than a book of criticism? I saw this as a clever way of teaching the reading public how to read more in-depth literary criticism.
Well, thank you very much. That's a kind way of putting it. I do think that people are more apt to read a biography. What I've always thought is if we could find a way to turn criticism into narrative, people would read it, but they don't read criticism, they read narrative. That is why biographies are so popular.
And it can be dangerous sometimes because as readers, we're always looking for autobiographical things in novels.
Exactly.
And authors often say, well, I made it up, so don't read too much into it. But what makes the novel The Portrait of a Lady worthy of a book like this?
I could answer that a dozen ways, but to start with, it's one of the things I say is the Portrait of a Lady is a novel at a moment of transition. It comes out in 1880, 81. The great Victorian writers are dying. George Eliot has just died. Dickens has been dead for a decade. The novelists like Flaubert and Turgenev are dying. And James draws on all that rich material, and then he pushes it forward into the next generation. It's the kind of bridge from which you will get from George Eliot on to Virginia Woolf, on to Joseph Conrad, the things that James does with the depiction of consciousness, with the manipulation of time. It's really the bridge to get from one century to another.
Well, I see George Eliot in this book very definitely, and in James in general. And I know that James met Turgenev, but Dickens?
Dickens is there for every 19th century writer. He's the climate they grow up in. James, I think, always wanted his books to be as much unlike Dickens as possible. He took Dickens as a negative example in some ways, something to react against. He's one of his essays, he said that too many novels, they end by sprinkling marriages and fortunes around like candy. And he didn't want to do that. So the ending of this book is open, it's uncertain, it's unhappy.
He's also writing this at a time when people are starting to think about psychology. Was he?
He was. His brother, is William James, the Harvard psychologist. And William, at the moment that his slightly younger brother is having a huge success with this novel and with other stories, William is struggling with his own first book, which isn't going to come out until he's 50. But it's a book called The Principles of Psychology. And it's a book in which he coins the phrase, the stream of consciousness. How much the brothers talked about this, nobody knows, but I think Henry got there just a little bit ahead of time.
You begin with an interesting story about being in a college class listening to a professor read parts of Portrait of a Lady aloud and not being able to follow him with your open book. Why was there a difference?
Well, James revised the novel. That is, it was published in 1881, and the text published in 1881 follows basically the magazine text that ran in the Atlantic Monthly. But he was never satisfied. He would take copies of his own book and begin to scribble in them to make changes to try to improve it. And over time, he began to believe that he'd written very, very badly when he was a young man. So near the end of his life, he makes a deal with Scribner's to do a collected edition. And he says what he's going to do as part of that is I'm going to revise. I'm going to bring my work up to the, my early work up to the level that it's reached now. So he begins to change adjectives. He substitutes words. He slashes out parts. He puts in new parts. He extends the metaphors. The style gets more complex. And, you know, there are certain key moments in The Portrait of a Lady, as in the later version, that just aren't there. The moments are there, but the descriptions are not in the first version. When I was a student, I had the first version. I'd bought the wrong book.
Well, some critics prefer the earlier version.
Some critics prefer the earlier version because the style is more straightforward, more direct. I can see that case with some of James's short stories. I think by the time he wrote The Portrait, his style had gotten just rich enough so that it can stand the revisions he did, later on.
My guest is Michael Gorra, G-O-R-R-A. His latest book, Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. We mentioned the brother's interest in psychology. They also had other brilliant siblings. Is it fair to call the family eccentric, the kind of family that might be interested in how psychology works?
I think that's an understatement.
Their
father was a crank. The father, Henry James Sr., was a religious crank. That is, he'd started out as a fierce Presbyterian, then he decided he didn't believe in God, or he didn't believe in a God that might punish people. When he died, he asked that his funeral service consist of these words: "Here lies a man who has thought all his life that the ceremonies attending to birth, death, and marriage are damn nonsense." They couldn't find a minister who would say that, but he also kept on changing his mind about what his children should do. It was materially a very comfortable existence, but psychologically there was a lot of turmoil and upset. And you know, you'd start out doing one thing, and your father would then tell you, "No, that's all wrong. You got to do something else."
Why did the family live abroad for so long?
The family went abroad because the father decided that he would find more interesting schools for his children abroad. He was part of his crank quality was he was a great believer in progressive education. Not to say that progressive education is a crank thing, but he would follow the rumors of an interesting school all the way across the ocean. When he got there, it was inevitably not what he thought it was, and he'd pull the kids out after a few months and go somewhere else. He put Henry into an engineering school at one point.
Well, today you can be anywhere in the world and know exactly what's going on in your hometown almost immediately. But in those days, there was a long gap. So Henry James missed an awful lot of American history or learned about it months later.
He
like
did.
James Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry or Bloody Kansas.
They get the news of Harper's Ferry from out-of-date American newspapers while they're abroad. They missed that whole run-up to the Civil War. And I think for Henry James, there's always a sense of removal from American life because of that.
Do you think it's the reason that my sense of him is very much as an Anglophile or a Europeanophile, whatever, as opposed to someone like Hawthorne, a man he knew, who was an Emerson, who was trying to create an American literature?
Right. They are. And Hawthorne didn't go to Europe until his best work was done. He went to Europe when he was around 50, after the Scarlet Letter. James, of course, had been a child and teenager in Europe. He would have denied that he was an Anglophile. He would say that he'd become a Londoner, but not Anglicized. Europhile, certainly, although he also thought that you had to guard against being too much in love with Europe.
Well, American art in general came out of European art. We tried to live by the standards of European art until a certain point where Americans started saying, wait a minute, we can do our own thing.
Yeah.
And he's at around that time.
He's
and his
time,
editor definitely is around one of the people involved in that thinking, William Dean Howells, who published him first in Atlantic. They had an odd relationship,
They had an odd relationship. James was often a little condescending to Howells. He thought that Howells had a wonderful prose style but needed to find better material to work it on. He thought that Howells found that material in A Hazard of New Fortunes. I mean, I'm a great Howells fan. I think he's one of the undersung geniuses of American literature. But he was a great novelist, but he also was, and this is rare, a great editor as well. Howells was a good friend to James when they were young, and then he became a great friend of Mark Twain. We often see James and Twain as complete opposites, but Howells is the link between them.
Well, Twain obviously is the man we associate with really the true Bertha Long with Melville of the American novel
of America as this wild place.
Okay. Are the characters in The Portrait of a Lady drawn from James's life?
Yes and no. The main character, Isabel Archer, is modeled on a cousin of his named Minnie Temple, who died of tuberculosis when she was, I think, 24. She never got to go to Europe. She never got to have the adventures that his heroine does. But she was hungry for them. And he sees Isabel, he admitted, is an extrapolation from her.
Isn't it also, to some degree, an extrapolation from Middlemarch, George Eliot's Middlemarch?
Yes, it is. It is. Because one of the things that James took from reading both Middlemarch and Eliot's later novel, Daniel Deronda, was the story of an intelligent young woman married to a monstrous older man, or an older man who certainly is not what she has expected, and who stifles her.
Now, you can't say that George Eliot ever has times when nothing happens, but people have complained that there are whole sections of James novels where nothing actually happens. And
some
think that's great, and some have real problems with it.
Well, it depends on how you define what happens. I think that one of the things that James does is he gets you to redefine what counts as an event, in fiction. So there's a famous chapter in The Portrait of a Lady near the end of the book when Isabel sits in front of the fire for 15 pages and she does nothing. She does nothing but think.
It sounds like Robespierre later.
But she does nothing but think, and yet in those pages, what she does is she comes to an understanding of her marriage that she has not had before. So that moment of doing nothing, of not moving, really throws the whole book forward.
On the other hand, he leaves out whole plot lines. There are these big gaps. Have to figure out what happened in between.
There's a huge gap. He skips over the first 3 years of her marriage.
Now, much has been made about James's possible sexuality. Is that reflected in a book like this?
His possible sexuality. I think that I think almost everybody now agrees that to the extent that James had a sexual life or had sexual interests, that they were directed towards men. Whether he ever had an affair with anybody, that knowledge is lost, and I doubt anybody will ever find it. I rather suspect that he remained celibate. Mm-hmm. Is this reflected in The Portrait of a Lady? People have often said that he has an especially acute understanding of women, and that could be related to his sexuality. I think that there is, in the way it comes out in James, is he has an interest in secrets and things people cannot bring themselves to say. That's there to some degree in Portrait. It's there especially in the work he does after Portrait, in the novels and stories that he wrote after that. They're loaded with people who cannot quite bring themselves to say what's most important to them.
The Golden Bowl?
The Golden Bowl is a story of in which a young woman has to come to terms with her husband's adultery and can't confess it to her father.
Michael Gora, his latest book, Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece. It is published by Live Right. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.